from the studios of WEKU on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University. This is Eastern Standard. Hello, I'm John Hingsbergen, and this week it's a Best of Eastern Standard program. This morning we've assembled some segments of some of the first 14 programs that we've produced during this recent series of Eastern Standard. It's really a relaunch of a program that had been on the air previously here. During our August 22nd show, let's get the show started here today with EKU President Michael Benson, the president of the university. He had been here about 6 weeks at that point, and he joined us in the studio for our inaugural broadcast. And one of the questions that I posed to him was about his plans for taking the university to what I called the next level, acknowledging that he had only been on the job for about 6 weeks at that point.
I do have some ideas, and again, in place is a really solid foundation. Our task, I believe, is to, again, carve out that unique niche for EKU, to promote it, to promulgate it, to get out in the high schools, to make sure we're getting our share of the high school juniors and seniors that are considering college, and the EKU is on their short list. It's to tell our story. It's to tell them that come to a campus where you're not going to get lost among 25,000 other students. It's a place where we really pride ourselves in creating a nurturing, caring environment where there'll be small classes taught by full-time faculty, and we'll have the advising in place that's necessary. We'll create these living learning communities in our freshman and sophomore housing, which, as you know, is required for those students to live on campus. That we create extracurricular opportunities. If a student wants to get involved in a service club or a Greek society or a religious organization, there'll be chances to come and be a part of the campus, not to get lost in a sea of kind of nameless students. And so I hope that people recognize that we're going to build on that foundation, but also take it, as you said, to the next level, raise some additional private resources, improve our facilities, get really aggressive in going after our alumni that may have lost touch with the institution. So in the aggregate, we've got a lot to do.
If your efforts at Eastern Kentucky University are successful, you talked about getting lost in the sea of 25,000 students. I guess the current enrollment is what, in the range of 15?
We're about 15,000 students.
If your efforts are successful, is that enrollment likely to grow, and the students will find themselves in the midst of a few more comrades?
I still need to do some due diligence as it relates to what's our kind of ultimate sweet spot. What can the campus hold in terms of infrastructure and both our faculty and advising needs? But I don't think we want to get too big. I mean, that's one of the, again, hallmarks of a campus like EKU and the beauty of the system in Kentucky. If you want to go to a larger campus, there are other larger campuses. But if this is the place for you, we're going to go after you and sell you on all the things that are unique to our campus.
What is your perception of the students who come to Eastern Kentucky University? Do we know something about them demographically? Are they from Kentucky? Are they coming from elsewhere? What percentage comes from these various locales?
The students that come to Eastern, yes, we service our service area, and enrollment management is really a science these days. I mean, we can break it down and know exactly where our students come from, the predominant high schools that are those feeder high schools, percentage of our population is from the region or out of state or even international. And one thing I really want to focus on is trying to create a campus, it's this way already, but even enhance it, where everybody feels welcome. Regardless of your religious affiliation or your political persuasion or whatever, you can come and feel like you have a place and you belong. And we can disagree, but we cannot be disagreeable. We want to create that nurturing environment where college is a place where you can explore and try different things and go into three or four different majors like I did. pre-med and biology is what persuaded me I wasn't going to be a doctor, or at least the kind that can fix people. our predominant demographic is that student that comes from Eastern Central Kentucky, and many times as the first-generation college student. And think about the change, the transformational change that has on, yes, their life, but the generations going forward.
Just in the last year and a half or so, Eastern opened a new science building, and I know that in your convocation address, Dr. Benson, you referred to plans and efforts to create yet another science building. I guess we still have science programs that are spread out and not in the new facility that just opened recently.
And the new facility is just top drawer. I mean, I've been in a lot of undergraduate and graduate science buildings, and I don't think I've seen anything nicer. We do have some of our faculty still in more science and some other locations. It'd be great to have everything under one roof. All the laboratory space, the lecture space, the breakout space, office space. So our big focus and our push with together with CPE and our other institutions is to see if we can get phase two funding for that this year.
We do have a couple of messages from our listeners as we encourage you to get on board and send us a tweet at WEKUEST, email us WEKUEasternstandard@gmail.com. Go to our Facebook page and post there, or call 800-621-8890. Eli from Madison County actually called in and has a question about the president's vision for the aviation program, since it is unique in Kentucky.
Well, I appreciate that question because I was out at the airport yesterday. I went out with Congressman Andy Barr, and I served on the airport board in Cedar City, Utah, where I came from. And I wanted to be a pilot, as it turns out, other things happen, but I love aviation. And our program really is unique. We have this kind of central airport that is in desperate need of additional apron space, some hangar space. Our program is really, I think, unique in Kentucky. And if you've been reading the newspaper recently, you'll see that there's going to be this huge shortage of pilots in the next 10 to 15 years. And some of these are coming out of the military with the GI Bill, and they want additional fixed wing or even rotary wing training. And I think together with the county, in concert with Congressman Barr and hopefully some additional federal dollars, we'd like to step up what we're doing out there at the airport and really support that program because it fits a really unique need for our state.
A couple of items you mentioned during your convocation are issues such as funding for a reading porch and plans for a new pedestrian mall on campus. Talk about those.
The Knowles, Ron and Sherry Lou Knoll, have been very generous to the university. They helped fund what I think is one of the most unique library spaces I've ever seen, the Knoll Studio, which you go anytime during the day, and it's this magnet of activity. And we wanted to create and replicate, really, a similar outdoor space. And so the reading porch was the idea that was broached with them from our library personnel. The challenge was to put on that side of the Crab Library this beautiful porch, but it overlooks what is now not a real beautiful space. And so we want to create a pedestrian mall because if you go down any time during the day, it's kind of this intersection of people walking different directions. And so make it more pedestrian friendly and beautify it. You know, little things like that that create these aha moments for a potential student that may be walking around campus with their parent and comes around the corner and says, wow, I mean, look at that space.
EKU President Michael Benson on our August 22nd show, the first of a total of 15 shows that we've produced this year, including this one. And that was a good conversation with a university executive talking about educational philosophies and a variety of concepts. And also on that program was Dr. Aaron Thompson, EKU professor and senior vice president for academic affairs for the Kentucky Council on Post-Secondary Education. Before we need to take our first break in today's show, let's take a break with Frank Tavares. You may recall the show we did during our fall fund drive in October. Frank Tavares has been was the voice of NPR's credit announcements for I think it was something like 18 years at least. And he was getting ready to retire, which he has now done. You've heard the new announcer, Sabrina Farhi, begin making the announcements on NPR. But during our program, this program back in October, we spoke with Frank Tavares. Frank, are you ever recognized in public? You know, you're standing at the counter in McDonald's or picking up your dry cleaning, and someone says, oh, I've heard that voice before.
It's funny, John. Every once in a while, and you'll be in conversation, I'll be in conversation with somebody, and I'll see this kind of puzzled look. And it often starts with, you know, you look very familiar because the oral cues and the video cues, the visual cues kind of cross in the brain. And depending on where I am, so I don't embarrass myself or somebody else, I might just lean towards them and say, well, do you listen to public radio? Do you listen to NPR programs? And if they say yes, and depending on how they say yes, I'll look around and see if anybody else is listening. And then I'll say, support for NPR comes from. And it's, I have to tell you, it still amazes me when they have that little flash of recognition. And one fellow said to me, "You're the dude," and I figured, I guess I am.
Well, I mean, it's got to, you know, in broadcasting, we all have some kind of an ego, but also a lot of broadcasters are kind of shy. I mean, I'm not the kind of person who goes out and immediately interacts with people when I step out the door from the radio station. How about you? Is that your personality naturally, or are you generally someone who's a little bit more reserved?
It's funny you should say this. I was talking with one of my classes yesterday, a class titled Fundamentals of Professional Presentation, and there are a lot of new students in this, freshmen, second-year students, and some a little closer to graduation because they were afraid of presenting information in public. And I come across as a very outgoing guy. I hope I have a good sense of humor, and I try to be very interactive. But what I tell them, I say, John, you're not going to believe this, but I really think of myself as a very shy person. I've just learned how to overcome that in a lot of different situations. And I've thought about that, what you just said about many of us in radio, and I wonder if that might have been one of the things that appealed to me when I first started way back in college radio, like many of our colleagues did, if that was part of it. You're working alone often. You know you're talking to hundreds or thousands of people at, well, college radio, probably dozens, at any one time, but you have this sense of, okay, it's just me, and as long as I don't say anything really dumb, it's going to be okay. So I hadn't thought about that.
Are you
thinking? I'm going to have to write a short story about that.
That's Frank Tavares, the voice of NPR for many years. Eastern Standard continues. Thanks for supporting WEKU. This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. I'm John Hingsbergen, and this week's program is a Best of Eastern Standard show. Thank you for tuning in, and thank you for supporting WEKU and the WEKU stations. You can support the station at any time by making a contribution online at weku.fm, and we are very, very grateful for your support throughout the year to help the WEKU keep programs like Eastern Standard and all of the network programs from NPR, PRI, and American Public Media on the air as the year goes on. During our programs of the last number of weeks, one of the programs we produced was on the federal government shutdown. That program featured Veterans Director Ken Lucas, director for the state of Kentucky, Representative Andy Barr, and actually Governor Steve Beshear. First, let's return to Representative Andy Barr and to Mr. Lucas. Mr. Lucas, again, because we do have the two Democratic and the Republican Party both representative in our conversation, do you have any reaction to what Mr. Barr has said about his concerns about the debt limit and the?
Well, here's the thing. When you talk about Obamacare, historically, Social Security was very unpopular with the other party. Medicare was very unpopular with the other party. Medicaid was very unpopular. And now these are staples in our economy. And, of course, we're going to have to adjust them so, you know, people, so we can live within our budget. But I predict that Obamacare will be just like these programs. And what is being left out is, instead of repealing this thing, is to change it and to work with it through the years, make adjustments, make changes. And they're talking about the huge cost of Obamacare. Well, it hasn't even been implemented yet to start increasing the cost. They're saying it's doubling and tripling, and the thing hadn't even gotten started yet. I predict in 3 years, Obamacare will be a big hit. There will be many adjustments to it that will get it in line, and I'm sure there are lots of things that need to be adjusted. But it'll be a wonderful thing for all the many millions of Americans who don't have health care.
Let me toss out this comment from a listener, Eugene from Barbersville, called in. Politicians keep saying that Obamacare is going to raise costs, but what about the cost already associated with hospitals treating uninsured patients? Doesn't that raise the cost of health care already? That message from Eugene from Barbersville. Mr. Barr?
Well, yes, of course. And one of the concerns that we have about Obamacare is that it includes deep, deep cuts to our disproportionate share hospitals, our rural hospitals. And that's really the problem we're facing. We don't have unlimited resources. And so when we talk about the popularity of Medicare and Social Security, that's true. And that's wonderful. And you know what? Retirees and seniors have earned their Social Security benefits and their Medicare benefits. The problem is that the government is going to start breaking its promises to seniors when they start to retire. The trustees of Medicare say that within 12 years or so, Medicare, the Part A, is going bankrupt. And so it's not a question about whether or not we want people to be able to have retirement security or health care security. We do. But we just want to make sure that the government can keep its commitments. And we have a huge unfunded liability in both Social Security and Medicare right now. And it's not an ideological or philosophical thing. It's not a Republican or Democrat thing. What it's about is math. It's about simple mathematics. And there is not enough money to fund all of these programs all at once. And so what I would say is look, I want health care security for everybody. I want retirement security for everybody. But what we don't want to do is have the government make promises to everybody and then break those promises. What we want to do is force the government to start living with it in its means so that when people retire, when people need health care, the government can actually deliver on those promises. And regrettably, you see Obamacare raiding Medicare right now. And in the near future, when Obamacare is fully implemented, because there's just not enough resources right now. And in fact, we've got a $17 trillion national debt and huge unfunded liabilities out there. What we want to do is make sure the government can keep its promises.
And let us now welcome Governor Steve Beshear to our program. Thank you, Governor, for being part of this week's Eastern Standard on WEKU. You called a news conference to speak about the government shutdown. I know you were fully aware of the fact that it could have been over within hours, which it was. You had some very strong words for our federal legislators. Tell us what your message and your feelings about this, the resolution of the partial government shutdown at this point.
Well, first of all, thank goodness that enough of these folks finally came to their senses to get the government back up and running and to avoid having us default on our debt around the world. Quite honestly, I've been frustrated, disgusted. You sort of named the derogatory term, and I think I could buy into it, and I think that most Kentuckians and most Americans have felt the same way. This is no way to do business. It amazes me that we continue to pay these folks to go up there and act like a bunch of kids in the cafeteria having a food fight instead of sitting down like adults and working through these things. You know, what we ended up with, which at least got the government running and pushed the debt ceiling problem off, but that's all they did. They basically kicked the can down the road again for about 3 months. And they could have done that 3 months ago. We're at the same place we could have been 3 months ago, and instead they manufacture this crisis, maybe so they can say they saved us from it and accomplish something. But it's just disgusting to watch this display of childishness in Washington, D.C.
How do you feel the shutdown affected the state of Kentucky? Mike Manjot is here. Travel commissioner says that we don't quite know the economic impact on travel and the overall economy. Do you feel that the state was hurt?
Sure, the state was hurt. I mean, just folks knowing that they couldn't come and get into some of the national parks that we have. I do know as a fact that we had just finished building a new facility in Glasgow for our aged population with behavioral disabilities. We were just ready to move them in from this old dilapidated structure that we've had for lots of years. And the last thing to do was to have about a two-day licensure process, and then we could move those folks in. We couldn't move them in.
The Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, was, of course, at the center of the debate during the partial government shutdown. How do you feel about the Kentucky's system, Connect, that opened up on October the 1st?
Well, according to all reports from all over the country, our Connect, our system, our health benefits exchange here in Kentucky is the gold standard. I mean, it is working better than any other exchange in the country. I turned on NBC Nightly News Friday night, and there was a story about the federal exchange and the problems it was having. And then they said, but let me show you one that is excellent. And Kentucky popped up, and they talked about how we were doing for about 2 minutes on national television. You know, it's going great guns. We've had, just in the first 2 weeks, about 240,000 Kentuckians swarming all over that website and calling that toll-free number to find out about how to get affordable health care. We've been signing up people at the rate of about 1,000 a day. You know, you don't really have to like the president. You don't have to like me. All I ask you to do is just go on there, make that call, sit down and talk to one of those connectors and find out how you might be able to get affordable health care for the first time in your life.
Governor Steve Beshear, among the guests in our conversation on the federal government shutdown that aired on October 14th on WEKU. Of course, that was the day before the federal government shutdown actually ended. We've considered that a very timely conversation with Governor Beshear, with the Veterans Director and former Congressman Ken Lucas and Representative Andy Barr. And we appreciate our listeners tuning in and supporting WEKU. This program aired during our end-of-year fund drive on WEKU as we ask listeners to support the station that brings you Eastern Standard. You're welcome to make a contribution right now by visiting the website at weku.fm, and we'll be very grateful for your support, and you will hear the results of your donation in the quality of our programs during the coming year on WEKU. That web address, once again, weku.fm. Stay with us. There's more of our Best of Eastern Standard program coming along. This is Eastern Standard on 88.9 WEKU and our network of WEKU stations. This week, we're calling the program The Best of Eastern Standard. We hope you agree. We've only done 14 shows before this one in this series of Eastern Standard shows, but we're pretty happy with what has happened so far, and we hope that you have enjoyed listening to them and maybe even learned something along the way. And among the topics of the program so far this year was the historic March on Washington, the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. The anniversary was August 28th. We happened to have a show on August 29th. Guests were Everett McCorvey, director of the UK Opera Theater and a native of Montgomery, Alabama, Lexington activist Don Pratt, and Reverend James Thurman, president of the NAACP in Lexington. Don Pratt talks with us about efforts to integrate in Kentucky. Jim Thurman talks about the promises that the Constitution of the U.S. made for all of its citizens. And we begin this segment with Dr. Everett McCorvey discussing his growing up in Birmingham, Alabama, under segregation.
It was a part of our daily life, and my family was very protective in terms of trying to help me and my cousin who lived with me to have a normal life. I remember being in the second grade out at recess one day, and there was a Southern Christian Leadership Conference meeting going on in the church across the street from where we were out on recess. And all of a sudden, I looked up the street and saw about 20 policemen on horseback coming down the street, and all of a sudden they got to the church, and instead of getting off of their horse, they went up into the church on their horses and beat all of the people out of the church. And
why? What was going on?
Well, there was a meeting going on in the church related to planning of different civil rights events, and It was a scary. I remember the teachers coming out and getting us all and pulling us into the room and just turning the lights off and not moving, but you could hear the screams and of the people out in the street as this was happening. I remember not being able to go into certain stores. I remember going into a store one time with my mother, and the white shop owner stopping me, accusing me of stealing, and calling the police. And I had not done anything. And of course, when the police got there, they saw that I hadn't done anything, but it was just those sort of things of intimidation. But my parents always tried to help me to understand that this is where we were in our society at that point, that things were going to get better. And of course, they were very involved in Martin Luther King's preaching of nonviolence as the course of action and the way to go to achieve better equality in this country.
What did the march in 1963 mean in your household? You were in school, 8 years old or
so? Yeah, it was a celebratory time. I remember it. And I remember we did have a television, and I remember the family gathering around the television and watching the march. And my family, my mother, neither my mother or father went to the march, but they were very supportive of it, and they wanted to make sure that I knew about it, and my cousin. I'm an only child, but I had a cousin who lived with me all of my life. And they made sure that we understood the gravitas of the of the moment. And they wanted us to remember it.
Were you cautioned from the earliest days of going to school and being
always,
know, careful in what you did?
Well, you know, schools weren't integrated in Montgomery until I guess I was in the sixth grade. Up until that point, I went to there was a laboratory high school at Alabama State Teachers College. It was a black college, and they had a lab high that went from first grade to 12th grade, so that the students could have the college students could practice teach, because they couldn't go into the public schools unless you went into the two black public schools, public high schools, or there were a couple of black middle schools and elementary schools.
And these are white teachers.
But these were black students. It's a black university. Okay. It's a historically black university in Montgomery. And the Teachers College had this laboratory high school. So that's where I did my first years of schooling. And so I was in the seventh grade when I finally went to integrated schools, and schools that just integrated the year before. And it was scary there, too. My father would be there every afternoon to pick me up and to make sure that I didn't get into trouble, you know. And so I think that inside of the schools, the teachers were I can't say that I remember the teachers being negative in any sort of way. But, you know, middle school kids will be middle school kids.
Don Pratt, need to hear from you here. I guess there was a relatively small population of minorities, African Americans or other races, compared to the white population. Was there a lot of tension that you experienced or noticed?
Well, the move to integrate the schools was a lot easier in Lexington, absolutely, even easier than in Louisville. And they moved pretty easily through that process, which I didn't understand. But the thing that they did, which was just highly discriminatory, was they closed the black schools. And that closing basically made a lot of inferior teachers out of very good black teachers. And they were moved into the white system and not really promoted as many of them should have been because of both their talent as teachers, but also the prejudice of the white students and the white parents, which dominate school systems even to this day for the most part.
You know, one of the things that I always am talking about is the hands-on activities in schools. You know, we concentrate on reading, writing, and arithmetic in school, and we have all these STEM programs. But I always think I want to put the arts in there, because if we give people the opportunity to learn instruments, to be in theater, to sing, and to be more involved – it's not that it keeps them out of jail, but what it does is it brings people together so mm-hmm. that they can work together to see and get to know people.
You've seen that on the stage and in the classroom?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so I think that that is a problem because there's a disproportionate number of African Americans in prison.
Jim Thurman, why don't you make a closing comment, then we'll get to Don Pratt and ask Everett to wrap us up here.
One thing that people seem to forget is that Dr. King was fighting for all people. When all people, regardless of race, creed, color, disability, etc., when the resources and the expectations can be realized by every American, then will America be America. America needs to be true to all of its citizens, what it says it is on paper.
Reverend James Thurman, pastor of Shiloh Baptist Church in Lexington and president of the Lexington NAACP, activist Don Pratt, and Dr. Everett McCorvey, who grew up in the South under segregation, is now a major player in the arts and education communities, not only in Lexington, but nationally recognized. On September 5th, Eastern Standard took up the topic of fairness ordinances in Kentucky. The previous week, Frankfort had passed such an ordinance prohibiting discrimination in housing, employment, and public accommodations based on sexual orientation, becoming the fifth community in the Commonwealth to do so. Guests on that program were Mayor Johnny Cummings of VICO, Kentucky, who received national publicity, including a fascinating piece on the Colbert Report, also Chris Hartman of the Fairness Campaign, and Martin Cothran of the Family Foundation, making the case that such ordinances were not needed. Mayor Cummings, let's pick up with you just to talk about what happened in VICO, Kentucky. It's a tiny community, 330 people, is that right?
Yeah.
How did a fairness ordinance happen to come about?
Well, you know, I was a new mayor. We was in the process of, revamping all the ordinances. A lot of things was out of date. And since we was doing that, you know, that had been on my desk for a month or so, and I, why not? I mean, it's the right thing to do, as Mary Lou said, and you know, as a gay man, you know, it was a given, so we put it through. You know, everybody seemed to be okay with it. You know, we had a couple of disagreements, which you always will, but it passed, and then it's just landslide.
Many of us have never lived in a town as small as VICO, but am I correct, or is this a stereotype, that in that town everybody knows everybody?
It's very true. It's just like after the Colbert Report, people saying, how's it feel to be a celebrity? I said, there's no difference between it being a celebrity and white trash, because everyone still knows my business, because that's the way it goes. And you know, but in that town of a community, everyone loves each other and cares about each other despite they agree. You know, when you have to look at your neighbor every morning, as everyone else in bigger cities doesn't have to, it changes some of your viewpoints, and I think that's why it passed in such a small town.
Are you a native of VICO? Or?
Yes.
Have you ever been, quote, in the closet in that town?
Everyone knew I was gay before I did, so no. We had no closet.
Okay, appreciate
it. We poor.
That's an interesting background, and we certainly want to hear more about the experience in VICO. Chris Hartman, let me get some perspective from your organization. The Fairness Campaign has a goal of getting into place legislation such as that in VICO, and apparently you were involved in encouraging that to happen?
Certainly, we've been advising any community that's looking to pass these types of anti-discrimination protections. We talked with Mayor Cummings and came to town to talk to the other folks on the city council. The measure, as Mayor Cummings said, passed easily, 4-1. This is what we're seeing in communities where the leadership is willing to talk about the issue, is that there is majority support, typically among the elected officials, but definitely among the population. You know, we know that 83% of Kentuckians support these simple anti-discrimination fairness protections. And again, this doesn't address the marriage issue or relationship status at all. This is just about folks having an equal and fair shake to earn a living, put a roof over their heads, and eat at their favorite restaurant without the fear of being turned away just because of who they are.
How do we know that 83% of Kentuckians support this approach?
There's recent polling done by the Shapiro Group. It was released early in 2011. That's the most recent polling on these fairness issues. And again, across the state, Republican, Democrat, Independent, all massive majority support.
Martin Cothran of the Family Foundation is on the line with us this morning. How does your organization view the fact that a town as small as Vico passed the Fairness Ordinance? And further still, all of the media publicity, such as the piece on the Colbert Report and so forth, that would certainly put Vico and Mayor Cummings in a positive light.
Well, gosh, if the Colbert Report approves it, then it must be good, right?
Well, Martin, you're just upset they didn't call you, aren't you?
Huh?
You're just upset they didn't give you a call, Martin.
I may not accept that call.
Oh, right.
Anyway,
okay.
You know, I think that the if it makes the town of Vico feel better, I guess that's fine. But the problem is, what did it solve there? How many cases of discrimination were going on in Vico? You just heard the mayor say he didn't even have to be in the closet there. There wasn't a problem. In regard to Chris Hartman's remark that a majority of the people support this, I'd love to see the question, because you can very easily get the result you want by how you phrase the question.
Martin, if you didn't read the question,
poll that matters is the one in the legislature. These are people who are elected by voters. Now, if there's this kind of popular support, then they should be able to get their bills passed, but they're extremely controversial. Why is that? Because a lot of people have a problem with it.
Fairness ordinances in Kentucky, a topic of a recent Eastern Standard program. This week's program is the best of Eastern Standard, and we're inviting you to support WEKU during this end of calendar year fund drive by calling 800-621-8890 or by donating online at weku.fm. Coming up in our next segment, the Bluegrass Pipeline and domestic violence, a couple of other major and very important topics that we've addressed on Eastern Standard. We hope that you'll help us pay for the station that brings you Eastern Standard every week. That phone number again, 800-621-8890. This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. This week's program, the best of Eastern Standard. Hello, I'm John Hingsberg, and thanks for joining us, and thanks for supporting the WEKU stations. You know, this past summer and fall, the Bluegrass Pipeline was a major topic of discussion across the Commonwealth, and remains so today. Eastern Standard chose to tackle the topic. And in that program, Tom Droege, a representative of the partnership planning to build the pipeline project, was one of our guests on the phone line. Sister Maria Vissi of the Loreto Sisters talks about her group's efforts to rebuff the pipeline, both on their land and in the state at large. But first up, we hear from Tom Droege.
It's no secret that the demand for energy is growing in America. Demand for NGLs is growing, and as a result, we need additional infrastructure to move NGLs. Bluegrass Pipeline will help meet that demand, and in the process, we're going to create jobs in Kentucky, we'll create additional new tax revenue for Kentucky, and we'll allow Kentucky to continue to contribute to the American economy. We estimate that about 1,500 jobs will be created during the construction part. We'll be hiring welders and skilled laborers. These people will be eating in local restaurants, staying in hotels, buying services and supplies locally. We also estimate that the pipeline will generate approximately $136 million in new tax revenue for the first 10 years to schools, towns, and other local recipients in Kentucky.
Give me that number again, Tom. I'm sorry, I didn't remember.
$136 million in new tax revenue over the first 10 years to schools, towns, and other local recipients. And we found, as we've been meeting with local communities up and down the route in Kentucky, that the local elected officials are quite excited about that. Landowners, we estimate between $30 million to $50 million in payments will be made to property owners in Kentucky so that we may purchase an easement, which is approximately 50 feet wide. The easement allows us to install the pipeline. It'll be, for the most part, 3 feet deep. That was a question we heard a lot. Is this pipeline going to be above ground? No, it's buried at least 3 feet deep, and it's we restore the easement. People can continue to use the land. They continue to own the land. They can raise thoroughbreds, grow crops, continue to enjoy their property. Well, We're merely asking for an easement.
Let's get Sister Maria Vissi on the line. She represents a property owner, namely the Sisters of Loretto, and we know there's been a bit of an issue related to the possibility of the pipeline crossing what's called the Kentucky Holy Land. Sister Maria, tell us about your interactions with the pipeline builders.
Well, actually, my interactions with the pipeline builders have been very short, because the gentleman approached us wanting permission to do surveying, and we had begun to know something about this liquid gas transfer, and so we said no. And that will remain. I know there are whole other questions about the use of eminent domain, et cetera, but as you can see from the gentleman's presentation, they have looked into all these things and will have answers. We've seen from the, for example, the Elizabethtown meeting that we went to, there are answers for any and all objections. And certainly no one is going to not want, for example, $30 to $50 million in payments to not go into their pockets. From the very beginning, what we've said is that we're not making any judgments on anyone's decision to allow or not allow the pipeline to come over it. What we've said is we do not want it to come through our property because since 1824, we have been those who have cared for this land and made it productive. And we don't want to run the risk, because there are risks, of having that pipeline come through here. And so that's a no. Now, can we be overrun? We have no doubt that the use of eminent domain certainly could override any objections we have to this.
Our conversation about the Bluegrass Pipeline on September 12th on Eastern Standard. Today, we are airing the best of Eastern Standard, inviting listeners to support WEKU by calling 800-621-8890. You know, October was Domestic Violence Month in Kentucky and across the country, and we chose to discuss that topic with Darlene Thomas, director of the group Greenhouse 17, and Kentucky First Lady Jane Beshear. Jonice Franklin hosted the show, discussing laws that are on the books or in talks in Kentucky to help victims of domestic abuse.
Darlene, we'll go back to you. What laws, maybe not in grand detail, but if you can give us an idea, I know there's a dating violence law. We're going to talk more about that later on in the hour with the co-sponsor of that bill. But what laws are on the books in Kentucky right now that help with domestic violence issues?
Well, I think Kentucky has been a leader in this nation for many, many years, looking at how progressive it's been. We were one of the first states to do interstate enforcement of protective orders. When you look around the nation, almost all protective orders look just like Kentucky's. So our protective order system is really excellent. We've made it accessible, and it's 24/7. Our legislators have really gone above and beyond. We have a representative now that's looking at how we can encourage landlords to allow people to move should they need another safe place to be, like leave their apartment without being penalized in any way. Kentucky's just been phenomenal overall.
Do you feel like a dating violence law would really help in the state of Kentucky?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Now, that's something we've had on our agenda for quite a long time through the state association, and have wonderful partners in our legislature and from our governor's office. And we're very fortunate that hopefully we'll get that passed this year. Dating violence is important because there's a whole group of individuals that may not be living together or have a child in common.
Sure.
Or have been married, that find themselves. Domestic violence doesn't discriminate. It doesn't matter whether or not you're living together. It's a pattern of behavior that far too many of our young people experience. And sometimes older victims who may be older in age and find themselves in dating situations that aren't living together, that need the same kind of protection. We really need equal protection under the law.
We're talking about domestic violence on Eastern Standard. I did read a statistic in my research. Nearly one in five teenage girls who have been in a relationship said a boyfriend threatened violence or self-harm if presented with a breakup, which I think is just alarming. One in five teenage girls you know, to be at that age and experience this type of, you know, violence at such a young age. I think it's a statistic that maybe people listening don't think about. We don't think about the younger generation.
That was exactly the reason that I mentioned that story out of Florida, was that this was a high school couple, because she wanted to go on to college. He became extremely violent. Mm. I mean, to stab someone 32 times, there had to be a history of that, of some kind of behavior before it reached this stage. And that story just ought to send shivers through any parent.
Mrs. Bashir, how do you feel about the laws in Kentucky that are currently on the books regarding domestic violence? Do you feel Kentucky is still a leader in this area? Do you feel there's more that we could do?
Yes, I think we're a leader, but yes, I think there's more that we can do. We are only one of four states, three or four, Darlene can correct me on whether it's three or four, that does not have this this dating violence law. And I think it's imperative that we do, because if we can cull the problem when our kids are teenagers, we hopefully can have an opportunity to educate these young people so they don't end up in that kind of a relationship again, and perhaps we can find some way to help the perpetrator early before he or she becomes even more violent. So I do think that's a tremendous addition. And the other piece of legislation that Darlene mentioned that will be presented and this next session is being able that a person that needs to move can break their lease if they are fearful of their life. Therefore, they're not penalized. And either way, remaining in a dangerous situation or financially being penalized. So I think these are two things that add to it. Have we reduced it in Kentucky? I think to a degree, but there's still far too much of it that's happening. The shelters are full. They have waiting lists. They work with people that are not necessarily in the shelter, but are in that in need. Somewhere, somehow, some way, we have got to change the culture. It's just not right.
We're talking about intimate partner abuse, domestic violence on Eastern Standard. I'm Joni Franklin. We'll go to the phones. I believe Susan is on the line.
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, Susan. Thanks for calling Eastern Standard. What's your comment or question for our guest about the topic?
Well, I have a situation that's been ongoing for 20-plus years. My perpetrator's from an old wealth family. There are three obstruction of justice crimes that have been committed in this case, and he has threatened to cut me up and put me in an ice chest. I was in the nursing program at LCC. In February of 99, he had my car wrecked, and I had to drop out of the program because he wouldn't quit relentlessly stalking me. And he has my home bugged, has a tracker on my car. Anytime I threaten to go to the police or the Commonwealth Attorney's Office or the FBI, he'll send somebody out to threaten to kill me. And I would like Jane Bashir's help personally in this case, because I'm almost dead. I've got a stent in my heart that's directly related to this, and I'm having chest pains, and I don't know what to do. Just let him keep murdering me?
No, certainly not. Darlene can probably be more of, again, give you more direction than I can, but no, you should not continue in a situation where
down.
You fear every day for your life.
What do you say to someone in this situation, Darlene? What can we say to someone living in this type of situation every day?
Well, first of all, we have to validate that intimate partner violence is extremely terrifying for those experiencing it. Mm-hmm. And there are many obstacles and barriers, is what I'm hearing Susan say, that she's run up against on multiple occasions. What I typically like to do, because one of our goals is to create a safety plan, is to wrap people in choices and options. Talk to them, help them understand what can and can't be done, and how our organization can help. And I'm not quite sure where Susan lives. There's 15 domestic violence programs across the Commonwealth. One of those programs should be able to sit and help them problem solve and make those connections and provide legal advocacy, support, counseling. And I think that's how people heal. That's how people begin this new journey, is when they know that they do have support around them. And so I would encourage Susan to let one of our organizations be that support.
Wow. Wasn't that an interesting and powerful program, a program on domestic violence? And I'm in a position to say that because Joni Franklin hosted that program. It's part of what we're trying to do here at Eastern Standard. I mean, if what more can we do than to help someone? And it seems that we were actually helping someone there who was in need of help. You've been listening to Eastern Standard today, this Best of Eastern Standard program. I'm John Hingsbergen, the executive producer and regular host of the show, as well as WEKU program director, asking you to support the station during this end of calendar year fund drive. Eastern Standard is produced with the help of literally everyone on the staff of WEKU, especially Jonice Franklin, our technical director and backup host, Charles Compton, our news director, Julie Tennell answers the phones each week, Stu Johnson has contributed to the show, and engineer Bill Browning has made it all work and keeps the equipment working. Of course, GM Roger Duvall has been actively involved on many levels, including filling in as board operator a couple of times. Two student producers have been invaluable and essential, Richard Turner, who put today's show together, actually, and Andrew Moorhead. And while some of these folks are not paid, certainly nothing beyond our regular salaries, this show uses a lot of resources, and we hope you agree that it's worth it. You've heard of higher education discussions, civil rights, fairness ordinances, the Bluegrass Pipeline, domestic violence, to say nothing of our shows on the government shutdown, on arts venues in Kentucky, veterans in Kentucky, and prescription drug abuse. We did a fun show regarding Halloween, actually on Halloween, talking about scary TV and scary movies. We hope you appreciate having Eastern Standard available on your local public radio station, actually your regional public radio station, whether you're in Corbin or Hazard or Pineville or any of the other communities we serve, Barberville, Frankfort, Harlan, Middlesboro, Pikeville. Call in now with your support for WEKU and Eastern Standard, 800-621-8890. Donate online at weku.fm. We hope to have an exciting series of Eastern Standard programs in the new year of 2014. Thanks to you and your support at weku.fm. I'm John Hingsbergen. Thanks for tuning in.